Really just thanking NBR for the extraordinary amount of support and resources they've plowed into sustaining this program, which from all the evidence one can gather has really made a difference over the last several years in terms of our ability to analyze what is happening in Asia and contribute to a wider public debate. The success of the volume always is a function of the contributions made by the authors. And this year is no different from any one of the preceding years. We've been extraordinarily blessed with contributions that have been uniformly excellent, which for those of you who have ever pulled together an edited book would recognize is always a challenge. And if you go through the chapters in this volume, like in previous volumes, you've actually managed to maintain a uniform set of standards, which is really something wonderful. One of the things that we've tried to do from the program's inception is to bring together a blend of both established and emerging scholars, because we always felt that part of the program's objectives was not simply analysis, but in a sense nurturing a community of scholars who could contribute. And we welcomed younger scholars from the beginning of the program. We were very lucky this time, though, to have in a single chapter, the chapter that we are going to discuss this afternoon, one established scholar and an emerging scholar who collaborated. And I want to make the point that this was genuinely a full collaboration. I mean, Linton always emphasizes that Mira's contributions were by no means second. This was a genuine contribution between someone who has spent many, many decades in the field and someone who we are confident is about to make a mark that will matter. I'm going to say a few words about both of the participants in the panel, not too long because you already have their bios. And let me start with Linton Brooks. I first encountered Linton Brooks actually long before I'd ever met him. In the early 1980s when I was still in Bombay reading international security and Linton's contributions to the debates about nuclear strategy and the maritime strategy. He spent 30 years in public service in the U.S. Navy and, of course, capped his governmental career by being the administrator of the National Nuclear Security Administration. Along the way, he was the principal negotiator for the United States during the START talks. And while he is freed of the shackles of governmental employment now, he is still deeply involved in a variety of institutions, including CSIS in the city, and is an active participant in nuclear debates. As I said, Meera Rapp Hooper is at the other end of the career spectrum. She's a PhD candidate in political science at Columbia University and is a Stanton Fellow currently at the Council on Foreign Relations. And her work has focused very much on extended deterrence issues, something that you will see when you read the chapter. She's also worked at the RAND Corporation and is in the process of completing a dissertation that actually looks at the role of security assurances and security guarantees in the context of alliances. I want to commend this chapter to your attention for several reasons. First, because it addresses what came through very clearly in the second panel, and that is the importance of U.S. extended deterrence to the character of the future nuclear environment globally. The choices that the United States makes with respect to its own nuclear forces and the character of the guarantees that it extends to our allies, not to mention the signaling to our adversaries, has enormous consequences for the choices that other nations in Asia make. And this chapter really gets at the heart of that problem, which is what is the appropriate extended deterrence posture for the United States in this second nuclear age in Asia. It's a very interesting chapter because even though it deals with a burning policy-relevant question, it does so with an extremely high level of academic integrity. And so both in the methodology employed and in the quality of the treatment, this is not a chapter that does a lot of arm waving. It is a chapter that explores some very complicated concepts with a great deal of clarity. And so I really commend it to you, you know, for for reading and reflection. This morning, I'm not going to ask Linton and Meera to follow the format we've done before, which is to speak for 5 to 10 minutes. But I thought I would ask them a series of questions that would give them an opportunity to elaborate some of the themes that are in the chapter before I open it up to the floor and then invite you all to join in the conversations as well. Linton and Meera, I'll leave it up to you to decide who wants to take the lead in answering the questions I throw your way. But let me start with the obvious one. If we talk about a second nuclear age, which is going to be characterized by the presence of many new nuclear powers, great diversity of capabilities, and countries that exist, in a sense, on the periphery of the international system rather than at the core, what do you see as the new operational and strategic challenges for U.S. extended deterrence in this environment? We know what it entailed during the Cold War. How has it changed? How does it matter today?
Let me start, and then Meera may want to add. We focused more on the strategic than on the operational. And we spent a little time in the chapter, which I will leave for your reading pleasure, to talk about where the Cold War provides useful guidance and where it doesn't. It seems to us that the thing that is particularly challenging strategically is the need to do three things simultaneously. One is to provide extended deterrence against China, North Korea in particular. One is to provide reassurance to our allies. You heard the discussion in the last panel about trends in Japan and North Korea that could lead them to question extended deterrence. And there's we start our chapter with a famous quote that it may take only 5% of your effort to provide extended deterrence, but it'll take 95% of your effort to convince your allies you've done so. I am paraphrasing. So we have to do those two things. But then in something which at least for most of the Cold War we didn't really have an analog, we have to do a third thing. And that is we have to reassure China that these things, which if you were sitting in Beijing would look a little bit like they're aimed at them, are not intended to thwart China's peaceful rise, because it's U.S. policy that we don't want to thwart China's peaceful rise. We just want to make sure it's peaceful. And so there's a tension among those three. Meera has coined a lovely phrase, which I am going to now shamelessly rip off, but it's her phrase, and her concept is what she calls a security trilemma. And the notion is that whatever you do to help your allies be absolutely certain that you've got a robust extended deterrent, by definition, will make China, that you're simultaneously trying to reassure, nervous. So we think that getting that strategy and the balance between those three is probably the biggest challenge. There are a handful of operational implications that flow out of it. I mean, part of an extended deterrence strategy is to be able to work together, so that suggests enough forces to do exercises. Part of any meaningful strategy is to have ballistic missile defense, so that suggests some cooperative ballistic missile defenses. But that's not really what we're talking about primarily in the chapter.
Yeah, just to jump in and elaborate for a quick moment. This concept of a security trilemma, I think, is important because we have multiple adversaries or potential adversaries that we're dealing with in this particular region. The reason that it's a security trilemma as opposed to just a traditional security dilemma is because actions taken to reassure allies that you will defend them against North Korea could have the unintended consequence of making China feel less secure and reacting accordingly. So that, again, is a change from the Cold War and a really important change that we're grappling with. And also just on the operational question, although the chapter certainly does focus mostly on strategic aspects of extended deterrence, we have mostly taken the position that operationally the United States is in a pretty good position, especially where nuclear weapons are concerned. In the region, we've seen calls recently, especially from South Korea, to potentially return U.S. tactical nuclear weapons to the peninsula. We've also heard concerns that the United States may not be able to make available dual-capable aircraft in a crisis. We are of the mind that the United States strategic deterrent is a very good one, very robust and reliable, and that dialogue such as the Extended Deterrence Dialogue and Extended Deterrence Policy Committee that our colleague Jim Schoaf mentioned are the way to communicate the sort of operational integrity of our nuclear deterrent to our allies. So we think that this is an area in which we're sound.
Mira, can I follow up on the concept of the trilemma? Because I find that extremely attractive. It's a concept that captures the challenges involving all the multiple players quite accurately. But the question I have is, when you have a trilemma, is there a stable equilibrium? Is there a stable solution to the trilemma? Or does one constantly kind of work to a solution by kind of feeling the stones? I mean, is there sort of a Nash equilibrium solution which tells you this is always what you do? Or are you constantly kind of groping between the three poles of the trilemma for what would be adequate to the situation?
I think in some respects, a security trilemma can have cross-cutting stabilizing effects. So it's a very good question. And the reason that is because China is obviously able to recognize that when the United States does things to augment its alliances, to make its extended deterrence commitments feel even more known in the region, China is aware of the fact that North Korea is the reason and that its security may be undercut as a result. As an example, the most recent set of exercises between the United States and South Korea, which took place this winter and spring, involved the United States overflying very publicly the Korean Peninsula with B-2 bomber, B-52s, rotating F-22s onto the peninsula. These things don't make China feel good. So those do create some sort of cross-cutting incentives potentially for the Chinese to restrain North Korea a little bit to whatever extent they can, and we're certainly not overbilling their ability to do so. But because there are three players in this game as opposed to two, there are these cross-cutting dynamics where potentially they can actually be stabilizing as opposed to exclusively destabilizing.
I do think, however, that it's probably not useful to think of some balance of policy which will lead to long-term stability without the need for statesmanship to manage it. I mean, this is a very dynamic region, and I think that one of our main messages is people who want to guide the formulation of U.S. policy are always going to have to look at this balance, and they shouldn't think that once they've looked at it once, it's over and they can go do something else.
Right. That's I think, a very useful reminder. Let me try and flag two challenges that I see coming up on the horizon, which is going to challenge us with respect to the success of extended deterrence in the years ahead, which I don't think we had in the Cold War. One is simply financial constraints. In the Cold War, we somehow found the money to sustain what was a very expensive arms race. And while we decry the expensiveness of the arms race, we were quite certain that no matter what the costs were, the country would bear them and produce the deterrent that we thought was necessary for our ends. As we look into the future, it's not obvious that the country is willing to make a similar kind of commitment. So the whole question of what does the lack of resources, particularly in the years going forward, the next 3 to 5 years, what does that mean for the reliability of deterrence? Is there anything at all, or do we have, in some sense, enough, in quotation marks, to deliver the job? The second reality, which again is new, is the new effort to de-emphasize nuclear weapons, what Michael Quinlan used to call the search for a low salience nuclear world. during the Cold War, we really didn't care about issues of salience. I mean, nuclear weapons were central. We emphasized them. We made certain that we were in this race to win. And it came out very well from our point of view at the end of the day. But now we are trying to meet all the requirements of extended deterrence while at the same time looking for ways to dethrone nuclear weapons from the central role that they had. How do we pull this juggling act off?
So that's an excellent question, and it is certainly a juggling act. I think, just to paraphrase a former Pentagon official who used to work very closely on these issues, we're of the mind that East Asian allies are less concerned with any particular aspect of American military power and more concerned with American staying power as they consider whether or not security guarantees are credible and reliable. Despite constraints on defense spending, we expect that the United States will continue to be a formidable military presence in the region, even as adversaries continue to build up both nuclear and conventional capabilities. But that said, U.S. allies certainly have specific defense concerns, and these do lie mainly, I think, in the conventional realm. The United States, again, has taken very good care to communicate the continued reliability and credibility of its nuclear deterrent through some of the mechanisms that we've already talked about today. But a lot of the challenges that we're seeing bubble up are increasingly conventional ones. But that said, it's not always simply a question of how will the United States do more with less, but how will the given alliance manage these problems? And in the case of both Japan and South Korea, we're actually seeing a fair degree of interest in the ally itself stepping up its conventional contribution to the alliance. In Japan, Japan has been relatively supportive, very supportive, of the United States reducing the role of nuclear weapons in its defense posture, and has very recently obviously shown itself to be willing to contribute much more in the conventional realm to the alliance. It's recently increased its defense spending, not hugely dramatically, but in a way that has clearly perked up China's ears. And this is after a steady decline in defense spending over the course of the last decade. It also has articulated plans to revise its previously existing interpretation on collective self-defense, which prohibits it from contributing to an alliance defense effort rather than a defense effort of its own territory or soldiers, which theoretically means that Japan could provide military aid in a far wider range of contingencies in the region. So actually, in the case of the U.S.-Japan alliance, one of the main tasks will be not just to consider how the United States can do more with less, but how the alliance can sort of find a new balance without destabilizing relations with China, as Japan does contribute more in the conventional realm to the alliance. South Korea is something of a different story, but again, involves the same balancing act between circumscribed nuclear circumscribed willingness to use nuclear weapons and an increased interest by the ally in conventional deterrence. The United States has been very careful when crafting its nuclear doctrine, particularly during the Obama administration, to make sure that its allies' concerns were heard and responded to as it did so. The United States has basically shied away from adopting a sole purpose doctrine in the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review, which would have said that the sole purpose of the United States nuclear arsenal was to deter or respond to nuclear attacks. And one of the main reasons that it did shy away from adopting this type of a doctrine was because of concerns in Seoul about what this would mean for South Korea's defense. And recently, Seoul has also adopted a number of recent efforts to bolster its own conventional deterrent posture on an individual basis. It's pursuing an independent ballistic missile defense program, and it sought and received permission from the United States to extend the range of its ballistic missiles on the peninsula from 300 to 800 kilometers. It's also adopted what it calls an active deterrence posture, which sanctions some amount of preemption in the case that North Korea appears to be readying any kind of nuclear attack on the South. So Seoul has certainly had some concerns about conventional deterrence and defense and has both voiced those to the United States, but also taken some unilateral actions to contribute on its own. It maintains a bit of worry about the upcoming transfer of operational control of the Combined Forces Command. In 2015, the wartime control of Combined Forces Command is scheduled to revert to South Korea from the United States. There are some fears in South Korea that this could diminish conventional deterrence on the peninsula. But again, this is an issue which the allies are dealing with very much in consult. They may once again push back the OPCON transfer, which has already been pushed back a couple of times. Finally, another sort of consideration with respect to balancing defense spending and needing to do more with less is the fact that the United States has clearly become interested in bolstering its relationship with the Philippines. And this is largely to do with the conflicts in the South China Sea that have been major news items in the last few years. The United States and the Philippines have had a long-standing alliance, but since the early 90s, the United States has not maintained any permanent military bases on the Philippines, and this obviously makes a defense commitment a little bit harder to execute. So the two countries are now in talks to potentially reestablish a U.S. military presence there on a rotating basis. The United States has also declared its interest in helping the Philippines build up its military capabilities, naval capabilities in particular. So all three of these cases, even though they are very different, would suggest that some combination of alliance management and balancing of resource constraints and needing to do more in the conventional realm can be achieved in different combinations.
For 5 years, it was my job to go up to Congress and whine that if I didn't get more money, the sky would fall. All right? That's the way executive-legislative relations work in the United States. It's important not to overanalyze that process. There's no conceivable future in which the U.S. nuclear deterrent is not technically more than adequate for North Korea, and probably no future in which it's not technically adequate for China. All these discussions about TLAM-N and dual capable air, those are surrogates for, not for can you do something, but can you convince us now that you're going to be willing to do something. This is an alliance management problem. I am pretty close to Senator Sessions in my views on abolition. I think it is unlikely to be feasible and not absolutely clear that it's desirable, but it's not going to happen for a very, very, very long time. And so in the paper, in the chapter, we argue that the United States should maintain its traditional second-to-none standard with the Russian Federation, not because it matters in military terms, but to make it clear to our allies that we don't intend to get out of the game. We argue that we should, as to its credit, this administration did, as Maris just told you, focus very carefully on the impact on our allies of any further policy statements. So I think that the fiscal pressures are very real, and they will make alliance management more difficult. But I don't think they're a fatal flaw. Awful capable military. I mean, I invite all those people who whine about, the Chinese, pick which side you'd like to command if we were actually going to fight.
I'm going to open the floor to questions because we have another 10 minutes or so before we adjourn. So let me start with Mike. Can we have a microphone?
Sure.
Thank you.
Mike Mochizuki, the Elliott School. Thanks very much for a terrific program, terrific panel. I wanted to ask a question that pivots off of what Mira was talking about, and it's really the relationship between the nuclear balance and the conventional balance. I mean, it seems clear that in the long run, we will be moving towards some state of strategic parity between the United States and China. You know, how it will happen is unclear, but if there's a drawdown in the U.S. Nuclear capability and an upgrade of the Chinese, we are moving closer to that. And at the nuclear level, this may mean stability. And so I'm wondering if there's a possibility of a stability-instability paradox operating that could operate in East Asia so that at the nuclear level, the United States and China basically are in balance. But increasingly, the conventional balance, despite the efforts to beef up the Philippines or whatever, is going to be moving towards the Chinese side. And at the same time, the kinds of disputes are kind of secondary or tertiary disputes for the United States. I mean, we have an interest in freedom of navigation, but are we really going to think about thermonuclear war or even a total war over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands or the South China Sea? So I was wondering, how you would parse this out.
Yeah, that's a terrific question. I think you've hit upon something really important, which is that, even if we're secure in our nuclear deterrent and our nuclear posture in the region, we do have these much lower level conventional disputes to think about. And I don't think this is even a future tense issue. I think it's a present tense issue. In particular, some of the things that we're still figuring out in terms of what we are trying to deter in Northeast Asia has to do with these lower level conventional conflicts. And in particular, conflicts around areas in which there are territorial maritime boundary issues. So one of the reasons why it's particularly difficult to deter a conflict in the Senkakus, in the South China Sea, or around the northern limit line on the Korean Peninsula is because, as you say, the United States has a limited strategic interest. So it does not make sense to say an attack on the Senkakus will be treated as though it were an attack on Washington. It's simply incredible. But another reason is because it's very difficult to draw red lines where these disputes are concerned. And that's in part because the United States does not take a position on other countries' territorial disputes. So if we're not going to take a position, we sort of have a varying spectrum of commitments to our allies who are in these territorial disputes, it becomes very difficult to project clear deterrent threats where any specific maritime or territorial dispute may be concerned. That's not to say this is a bad policy. There's a lot of good reasons not to state a clear line on how we feel about the Senkakus or how we feel about the Scarborough Shoals, and that may, be its own type of deterrence. But it becomes very difficult to deter limited incursions on those types of disputes when that is the case. So it is, absolutely an issue, not just for the future, but for the present, that we're really struggling with, not only in our chapter, but in U.S. government policy, and I think it will remain one in the years to come.
I would, however, push back a little bit and refer you to Jeffrey Lewis's chapter. We throw numbers around, and sometimes we don't make it clear. You heard Senator Sessions talk about 1,500 weapons, and then he talked about China having a couple of hundred weapons. But those are measuring different things. 1,500 is measuring things that are actually sitting on missiles. Total U.S. stockpile was announced at 5,100 in 2009. Most people believe it's a few hundred less than that, but still probably a factor of 10 larger than the total Chinese stockpile, a fact the Chinese point out frequently when we say, when would you like to get involved in arms control? And it's not at all clear to me that the time when those two numbers grow much closer is near, because I'm not sure I see further U.S. reductions we would advocate doing it only in connection with Russia, and that doesn't seem to be going well right now. And I think everything the Chinese are doing is internally consistent with their view of a minimal but very survivable deterrent. So on the one hand, I don't think the situation you describe is likely to happen soon, but the problem you address, I agree with Mary, it's here now.
Absolutely. Yes.
Hello, John Hanley again. But in your trilemma, if you cannot help to parse out where you're trying to reassure and where you're trying to deter the same party, if you treat it as a unitary actor, but actually factions within, the PLA versus China at large, there are clearly areas where we disagree. We agree to disagree over certain actions and the legitimacy of coercion, et cetera. And in those cases, we don't want to reassure. We would very much like to deter. And then sort of how this, there was a notion of shaky hand equilibrium, if we go back to our ancient game theory, on a lot of this deterrence. But, you know, by just the possibility of, you know, if you do this very rational calculation that says, you know, you'd come out one way, but there's always this possibility you might push the wrong button type of thing. And, you know, how does that, you know, constructive ambiguity is another way of looking at it, to play into this deterrence when you're trying to solve this trilemma. Thank you.
John, I think that, first of all, I agree with you, it's important to have communication with all the relevant players. Unfortunately, that's not particularly easy in China today, and it's essentially impossible in North Korea today, at least for the government, and I would argue in North Korea probably for anybody. So you just do the best you can. There's a fairly robust set of track one and a half, track two dialogues. I'm involved in a couple of them, which tries to get at the PLA indirectly. And I think that you simply have to manage it. I think it is also fairly clear that you have to distinguish between regional and global issues, particularly with China. We can tell China, and in fact our chapter advocates telling China, that our national missile defense is not designed against them. But it would be a lie to tell China that the missile defenses that we're putting in the region, that we're putting on Aegis in case this carrier killer DF-21D actually works, are not against them, because they are. And so I think that this century is going to be about cooperation and competition with China, and you're just going to have to manage that. That's the premise of our comments earlier, that, you know, don't look for an answer which will then endure. That, I don't think that's the way international relations works generally, but certainly not the way it's going to work in the East Asia.
Mike?
I'm Michael Gadbaugh with Georgetown Law School. I wonder if you could comment on a kind of counterpart dilemma. I don't know if it qualifies as a trilemma or not, but the challenge of giving these reassurances to our allies and maintaining the perception of our adversaries, even as we have to deal with our domestic political situation, where you see, as Senator Sessions was commenting, a kind of unholy alliance between the left and the right with respect to zero nuclear, as well as challenges to our strategic posture overseas, in the context of a very tight fiscal situation. To what extent will that make the kinds of assurances that our allies are looking for look like it is excessively costly in this kind of setting, and even more vulnerable to challenge with respect to the kind of whether we can really afford the kind of strategic posture that that you feel is necessary?
Fortunately, our allies are primarily democracies, and they know that there are a lot of voices. Our adversaries have a great deal of trouble in understanding the United States because they're not used to multiple voices in influential positions. But our allies are. Certainly, there's every bit as robust a political debate in South Korea as there is in Washington. I think, like so many things, this sounds like a cliche, and maybe it really is a cliche, but there is no substitute in these things for presidential leadership. And I think that one of the unfortunate consequences of the current fascination with abolition of nuclear weapons, is that for most of my lifetime, at the very broad level, there's been agreement on nuclear policy between the parties. Right now, there's not. I don't think that's what the president thought he was doing in Prague, but that's what he did. And so we have to, we have to work through that. But, you know, I mean, this administration, in my view, remembering that I was part of the previous administration, this administration has done a superb job with our allies, notwithstanding the fact that it's led by probably the most committed president in my lifetime, with the possible exception of second Reagan term, to abolition. And yet, I think the president's been very successful in convincing our allies that we're serious. So I think this goes primarily to leadership. It would be useful if we could reach consensus in the United States as we used to, but it's sort of hard to see that. I mean, I was recently involved in an effort to try and, among people who claim to be centrists, to reach consensus, a CSIS effort, and there was way less consensus than you might have hoped.
I would just tack on to that for a moment and say that while both of these sort of sets of constraints are true, sort of the circumscribed role of nuclear weapons or more dialogue about moving towards global zero and constrained defense funding, those are all sort of material indicators of our extended deterrent, which matter a great deal in certain respects. But these are at their core fundamentally political relationships. And part of why things like consultation mechanisms matter is because it's not just about having enough stuff to ensure the proper defense of your allies, but explaining to your allies what your stuff does and how it's going to defend them. And until basically the turn of this century, our South Korean and Japanese allies had very little knowledge of what the U.S. extended deterrent meant, how it was intended to operate, how it would provide for their defense if that became necessary. This was something that we did very well in NATO during the Cold War. We had an incredibly dense, rich institutional structure, which much of which still persists to this day. But we had no analogs in our East Asian alliances. And that meant that we were not sharing nearly the same kind of information, partially because it hadn't been demanded for a really long time. But those demands have risen up in the past few years, and the United States, I think, has responded very well to them by creating far more formal mechanisms through which to share information. So even though we may have to do more with less, we're also able to explain what we're doing with less in a way that I think is much more effective than it ever has been before.
I'm going to take one last question before we adjourn for today's.
Thank you. I follow up with Mira regarding the trilemma and bring in the fact that to China, they always say that it's their domestic issue that they're dealing with. And even though it has to do a lot with the Senkaku and everybody else, it's still their domestic. And come back to us, from the talk with Senator Session, I think it's also the fact that we are democracy and we have a great luck now with the fiscal issue. There also has been a lot of lobby efforts from China, we have no doubt about that, to exploit that democracy of us and to create more conflicts and more difficult with consensus. And since we talk about nuclear, can I ask you the position of Israel and Iran? Because yesterday we just had the Prime Minister Israel make a speech about doubting the good intention of the new leaders of Iran regarding the nuclear proliferations. So why China is dealing with its own over there, I think Israel has a lot of, they can be very supportive to the decision in Congress. And where do you see the internal tensions and effort can fit in to helping with your trilemma? You catch my questions? Mm-hmm. See, all the powers within, all the tensions, balancing of power and trying to create a consensus to help with your trilemma. Because I see that we also have the main issues is the concern, a survival concern of Israel against a nuclear power of Iran. And that also has to do with China is trying to put forth its rising as its domestic survival reason. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And then it comes back to our economic. It's not truly is the power of nuclear, but it's the market that we're looking at. It's the global market, because that's the main reason for the Asia, the pivot to Asia. We want to have the market over there. And I think it comes back to all the fiscal funding and market. So whether you see all these powers coming in, we're talking about U.S. and China, but I'm trying to see also the lobbyists inside the Congress and also the position of our very strong ally, Israel, and our very strong advisors, security advisors here in the U.S.
All right, let me start with Let me start with China. The Chinese are pretty blunt that the biggest threat is internal. I think the 2008 white paper, but I may be wrong, one of the white papers says that explicitly. And the problem is that the Chinese government has made a deal with its people, which is you don't push for political expression and we'll all get rich. And that is tapering off a little bit, and they're doing what authoritarian regimes often do, is they're emphasizing the external enemy. So there's a little xenophobia going on. I don't know that there's a magic bullet to fix that, but it suggests the point that Mira made about our allies also applies to China, that we need to maximize the dialogue so that to the extent that these are real concerns, we can mitigate them. To the extent that there are excuses for political, you can't. But I think that we have to work through that with China. And at the end of the day, China either believes that we're willing to see them so-called peacefully rise, or they don't. And, you know, we have to be ready to deal with either possibility, but we've got a preference. We did not deal with Israel and Iran, so this is not the chapter, and it's certainly not trying to co-opt Mira into this, but look, if you were in charge of the defense of Israel, you don't have to really believe that Iran is likely to use nuclear weapons. I don't think anybody believes that. And former government officials always give you a lot of wheelie words. But assuming that what everybody believes is true and that there's a fairly decent Israeli nuclear deterrent, Iran, that would be suicidal. But if you were in charge of a country that's only a few miles wide, you would not look with equanimity. And the prime minister, every prime minister of Israel, has tried very hard to convince the United States that if we don't do something, they're going to have to. And the problem we have right now is we don't know what to do. You heard a discussion in the previous panel about the weaknesses of military force, which I agree with completely, and you can look at the chapter and see more. So I think that's another one of these things where we just have to muddle through, but we did not analyze it. So I'm not sure that I want to associate either NBR or Mira or anybody who knows what they're talking about with what I just said.
Just to tack on one more comment about your good point that, of course, China's primary concern is a domestic one. This is, as Linton said, absolutely true, but again, something that can cut both ways. You could make a good case for the fact that because China has to be so concerned with domestic stability, that it should be relatively unlikely to push its agenda within the first island chain, et cetera, because it should not want to invite any instability in the region. But you could also make a pretty good case, especially where the Senkaku Diaoyu dispute is concerned, that's a great opportunity if China get the regime in Beijing gets into a difficult spot for China to diffuse some of that attention by invoking nationalism and a conflict that has serious domestic political roots and will invite a serious domestic political response. Unlike the South China Sea, where Beijing's interests tend to be more about resources and access, the Senkaku Diaoyu dispute is fundamentally about nationalism and has a huge domestic political component. So it's sort of an unpleasant and hopefully won't become one, but potential target for some kind of diversion if that were to become in Beijing's interest. So just something we have to keep in mind.
Well, thank you all. I'm going to end this session by repeating something that Linton said at the beginning. One of the challenges we're going to face with respect to managing extended deterrence in a stable fashion is not simply the material ingredients of capability, which, of course, we will continue to maintain no matter what our aspirations for abolition are, but the need for prudential judgment and statesmanship. I mean, there's no alternative to prudential judgment and statesmanship. And I think as long as we have those two elements, it's not always obvious that we will have those at the level of supply that we need. I think we will be able to muddle through even the challenges that we face with respect to extended deterrence. But what has been said today is obviously not the last word. This is going to be a continual work in progress, and I expect that future versions of Strategic Asia will come back to looking at some of these issues involving maybe other countries, not just in East Asia, but around the world. I'm going to yield the floor to my colleague Abe for a few final words before we let you go.
Well, before I give the final remark, can we thank the panel for a great thank you. Thank you so much. In his second inaugural address, Ronald Reagan called for an end to nuclear weapons on the face of the earth. And it's been almost 30 years, and we're still obviously dealing with an even more complex nuclear environment than we were then. And as Ashley said, it looks like all trends continuing that we'll probably in 30 years be putting out another edition of Strategic Asia, hopefully with Ashley still as running the program on the same topic. So thank you, Dr. Ellings, the president of NBR, and Charles Brady, our chairman, had to leave early for meetings on Capitol Hill. They are still doing things on Asia, even during the shutdown, which is good to hear. So they asked me to thank you all for coming, thank the authors, thank my fellow editors, Ashley and Travis, and thank you all for coming. Usually I'd say that we're adjourned, but given the context, I'll say we're shut down. Thank you.
Thank you. So if you're in here, you can come back.